Welcome. As we come to our 74th and final lesson in the Gospel of John, which I've entitled Christ is Savior God, John's theme. This is really the epilogue of our entire study. And basically, what I want us to do is ask the question, did John accomplish what he set out to do? That's all we need to do. Let's look at some foundational assumptions and principles first. Hermeneutical assumptions. These assumptions, they guide my hermeneutics, they guide my teachings. That is, that the Bible is inherent in the originals, yet God, being God, can preserve His Word. And He has done so through a multiplicity of available copies, wholes or partials. You say, well, that really isn't sufficient. But we look at some of the ancient works that we take as sufficient, like Homer's Iliad. We have, I believe, fewer than 10 copies. And the nearest copy to the time of Homer is about 1,000 years. If I remember that correctly, because I'm doing this part off the cuff. Ten copies. That's it. And from that, people went out and found the ancient city of Troy, believing it to be true. Yet they come to the scriptures, in which you can have anywhere from 5,000 to 7,000 copies. And some of them much, much closer to the originals by a couple of 100 years. That's in the Old Testament. The New Testament, time period is even closer together. And it's this multiplicity of copies that we can compare and cross-correlate and come to the understanding that translation that we hold in our hands reflects the mind of God in every major doctrine. They usually variate only on tiny points of prepositions or articles, things like that. It's fairly easy to determine what's been added and then to filter it back out. God's Word is the only source of absolute truth. And we'll cover why as we go through our lesson. But it is the only book that speaks authoritatively and claims to be the mind of God. Therefore, it has to be absolute truth. If you doubt on that, then the Bible is not truth. It is a truth, or it is a philosophy to be compared and competed with other philosophies, other outlooks of life. And unfortunately, this is how it's frequently done. The scriptures are breathed out from God into those men who wrote them down. Not as automatons, but through the complex mechanism of their own experiences and personalities that God gave them and brought them through. then we must have a way to reason. About the scriptures. Because if we do not, then they become a jumbled mess, as does any other book. And so I use the Aristotelian four laws of logic. Not that they began with Aristotle, he just wrote them down. The Bible doesn't write them down, the Bible demonstrates them. Just like the Bible never proves God. God is. And we go from there. So we start with the fourth law of logic, which is the law of reasonable inferences. And the reasonable inferences are based upon the law of identity. Have you defined, have you clearly defined what it is your main topic is, or what it is you're doing or measuring? Law of excluded middle. It's either A or B, it's not A and B. There's either truth or there's not truth, but there's not truth and non-truth simultaneously. That's postmodernism. And the law of non-contradiction. You're either here or there, but you're not here and there. And we'll clarify these as we go through. And then we have to understand that any discussion of the Bible is an exercise in forensics. Now, forensics will usually conjure to mind crime and murder and TV shows and all that mess. But forensics is a much older term than that. And what it is the study of logical debate or argumentation using what today we call scientific methodologies and logic, to establish facts and put them into a contextual matrix via reasonable inferences. So forensics has been around for a very long time. Deals primarily with past events, judicial and historical, are just two that easily come to mind. It's easy to establish facts. It's difficult to agree on what the facts mean. What is the contextual framework in which you are placing the facts? That is non-empirical. It's not scientific. That is faith. That is what philosophy tries to provide. That's what religions try to provide. I mean, in a court of law, you do not have to prove motive, but if you do not demonstrate motive, it will be very difficult to get a guilty verdict. Because the jurors want to know why. If you do not have the why, how do you know you have the who? Now, it's often disdained as being circumstantial, which is silly, because nearly all issues are circumstantial. If you do not directly view an event taking place, it must by definition be circumstantial. That is what forensics do. So if you say that, well, you didn't view it directly, therefore you can't know, well, that's true of many things. We don't see gravity. but we feel its effects. For most of man's history, man believed there was an ether surrounding the planets and all that out in space. Modern man decried that as silly until the 50s when we were able to launch satellites, and into the 60s, then we measured there are tremendous forces in space pouring out of not just the sun, but also the entire galaxy in which we find ourselves. And Earth even has its own forces that act as a protective shield most of the time. Ether. Not directly viewed. So what was the purpose of John's Gospel? Well, he tells us this in his opening hymn. And it's to this that we're going to look at over and over again during this discussion. Let's go to John 1, verses 12 and 13. But to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave, now in the ESV it says the right. But in the Greek it says exousia. He gave him the exousia of being children of God. Now, if man had the ability, inherent ability, to sense God, to know of God, to believe the truth of God, and demanded or came to God, petitioning God for salvation, then it would be a right. But that is not the case. To the natural man, the things of God are foolish. 1 Corinthians 2:14. He cannot accept them, cannot comprehend them. In fact, he is dead in his trespasses and sins. He can't even sense them. Therefore, it is not a right. It is a privilege that God brings. And he brings it of his own will. Romans 9. So he gave him the privilege to become children of God, who were born not of blood, nor the will of the flesh, nor the will of man, but of God. And down in verse 17, the law was given through Moses, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. So this is John's thesis. Is that salvation comes only through Christ. It does not come because man wants it. It does not come because man is born of a certain bloodline or performs a certain sacrifice correctly over and over again. It doesn't come because he wants it. Because according to Romans 3, 10 through 18, which is basically just quoting out of the Old Testament, there is none who understands. There are none who seek after God. No, not one. God seeks after us. This is the thesis of God, of John. That God has come to give us truth and to save those whom he will. Then the Gospel of John is to prove that thesis. And it sounds like free will, and this is the great problem, is that people will pull a verse out of context, like John 3:16. God loved the world, and whoever comes will be saved. And that is a very true statement. But the lost will not come. God has to go and get them. Adam did not come. God had to go looking for him. Abraham was an idolater. God had to go looking for him. David hid his sin with Bathsheba. God had to uncover him for him to seek forgiveness. We might opine about God and Christ and salvation, but it is Christ who comes looking for us and rips the scales off our eyes so that we cry, Abba, Father. We cannot take them off ourselves, just like Saul in the book of Acts could not take his off. He had to wait in darkness until the time chosen by God. And remember, it is not from works. It is not from law. It is not from anything of righteousness, because according to Romans 7, verses 7 and 8, and also down to 13, law only condemns us. The law empowers the flesh. Taste not, touch not, do not only empower the flesh. Monasticism only made the flesh stronger. Piety, though it masquerades as a type of Christian morality, is actually a satanic tool that strengthens the flesh and keeps people from the truth. And John makes a bold statement here. No one has ever seen the Father except the Son. Down in verse 18. No one has seen God, the only God, or the very God, or the divinity, divine one, who is at the Father's side, he has made him known. He, and he alone. We're going to look at this in more detail as we go through. But no one has gotten their truth directly from God. Now, a moment ago, I talked about those who were inspired, as we call it. God breathed out his truth and they wrote it down. We're going to discover that oftentimes they didn't have a clue what it was they were writing down. They go back and read it and reread it and reread it and study it, trying to discover the mind of God. And that is because 1 Corinthians 13:12. We all see as though in the negligence because our sinful body of flesh that we retain. It clouds our vision. It obfuscates or covers the light of the truth. And we can only dimly perceive the reality until we receive our new bodies. Well, in the Old Testament, they didn't have that. They were not of the new covenant. They did not have the indwelling spirit. They did not have the mind of Christ within them. Thus, their perception was even dimmer than ours is today. But Christ, who is with the Father, the monogenesis, the only begotten, the Son of God, got his truth unambiguously, directly from the Father, and has brought it to us. This is why John says Christ's message is the absolute unvarnished truth, insofar as we can understand it. So John wrote around his gospel around 85 to 95 AD, somewhere in that time frame, toward the end of his long life. And by this time, Rome no longer considered Christianity as a form of Judaism, which was a state-approved religion. Thus, Christianity was not approved. And most of the time it was ignored, but at times it was actively persecuted. Both in the time of Nero, and now here during the time of John. That's why he's on the island of Patmos. Because when it was convenient, then Rome would condemn Christians. Well, they weren't the only ones. After the temple destruction, Pharisee Judaism was the only form of Judaism to survive and entrenched itself in Talmudic philosophy and viewed non-Jews as goyim, among other things. Not had beforehand, but now this was the only view. And it's the only view today, by and large, in various degrees. Judaism rejected Jesus as God, considering Christianity a polytheistic idolatry. And of course, Islam, though they'll never admit it, is an offshoot of Talmudic Judaism and says the same thing in their Quran. And thus the Christians were facing persecution from both Rome and Jews. Remember, Saul, coming out from Jerusalem toward Damascus to persecute Christians in Damascus, was operating under the authority of the Sanhedrin. Well, the Jews would take matters into their own hands out in the provinces anyway. If you had Acts 14, verse 19, the Jews came to Lystra, riled the people up, so that they stoned Paul, dragged him out of the city, left him for dead. It was the Jews in Jerusalem, while he was still standing, who stoned Stephen in Acts 7, verses 54 to 60. They hated the truth. They still hate the truth. There's only one faith. That is the faith of the Bible. Now, upon Octavian's death, you know him as Augustine, or Augustus, the Senate deified him. Which is interesting. Hence, all emperors since were considered gods, and in emperor worship tied the empire together across multiplicity of religions. Foundation was the ruler, who was later we're going to know as the Antichrist, in the coming revived Roman-type empire. Rome always viewed its paganism as its true religion, eschewing Eastern religions as degrading sensualities, debauchery. Thus, when Julius Caesar commissioned a statue and had it placed near, you know, Cleopatra's goddess and had it placed in a public place, the Romans were not happy. And when Caesar was executed, that thing kind of went away. Rome was very conservative, in particular, about its religion, and accepted emperor worship as a means of tying together the empire across multiplicity of approved religions. As long as we all worship the emperor, we're all a part of Rome, you can have whatever sub-faith you want. It was not possible under Christianity. And at times, they paid dearly for that. So that's the historical backdrop in John's writings. John wants to make sure people understand that Christ is God. Not a God, not about God, not a prophet, not a man, but he is in fact God. And so he has to establish the law of identity. He has to establish who Christ is. Who is Jesus? This is at the heart of any Bible discussion, especially about salvation. Who is Jesus? Well, the Bible never defines God. God is God. God's existence is not questioned. It is an assumed fact. But the Bible does define Christ so that we have a clear understanding of who Christ is and why Christ is the only one who has knowledge, unambiguous knowledge of the absolute truth. Now, these synoptic gospels really didn't cover this. Yes, there are admissions throughout each of them that, you know, you are the Christ, you are the Son of God, you are God. And they leave it at that. They never explore the topic because that is not their viewpoint. Matthew is showing, is writing about Christ from the perspective of King of the Jews. Mark as a suffering slave from God. And Luke as Son of Man. But John establishes the eternality of Jesus as God with God. This is going to be a problem, especially for the Jews, as we talked about throughout several of our lessons. John intimately links Jesus with God from the beginning of this creation as Son. In John 1:14, it says, "And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. We have seen His glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth." Now, that word Son there in the English is actually the Greek monogenesis. He is the only one who came from the Father. But he has always been with the Father, but now he has come from the Father. He's full of grace and truth. That is why John begins as Genesis begins. A deliberate choice on John's part to link beginning of creation, this physical, material, current creation, showing that Christ was already existent. So when Genesis starts out, in the beginning, God, flat statement, God exists. John 1 is saying, in the beginning was the Logos. Logos can mean word. In the English, that's somewhat of a flat statement. Devoid of complete meaning. Christ is the Logos of the Father.
He is a complete representation of all that the Father is, which in John 4:24 means that as God is, the Father is spirit and truth, Christ existed as spirit and truth. Yet he was with God, but also he was God. So he's not an angel. So if your faith has, excuse me, Christ is an angel, that's not true. And there's no way to manipulate the Greek to make it say anything else. The Greek says he was with God and he was God. And he was in the beginning with God. Well, God's eternal, so he had no beginning. It's true. He did not have a beginning. But this creation had a beginning. And that is what John is talking about. He was the active agent of creation, bringing order from the chaos of darkness as the light. All things were made through him in verse 3. Without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. When you go back and read in Genesis, chapters 1 and 2, that's pretty much Christ in action. See, after the Father bara, this is where you need to know a little bit of Hebrew. Let's go to Genesis. And in the very first verse, in the beginning, God bara the heavens and the earth. We have it here as created because our language is not very descriptive in many aspects. So down through those 6 days, we have created, 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 created. But in the Hebrew, they're different words. When the Father barad, he made the visible from that which was invisible. Not wanting to hurt your head, but eternity passed before this creation, there was no space. There were no dimensions. There was no material. There was literally, absolutely nothing of nothing. Now think on that a moment. That'll hurt your head. So the Father barad, and there was space. There were dimensions. There was matter. And the Spirit was hovering over this dark chaos, doing nothing, meditating, waiting, fluttering and waiting. Well, who was the Spirit waiting for? Why was not the Spirit the active agent? Because that was not his place. He was waiting for the Son, who appeared in verse 3. And the Father said, let there be light. There was light. God saw the light was good. And he separated the light from the darkness. And he called the light day, and the darkness he called night. There was evening and there was morning, the first day. Now we know it's not physical light, because that's not created till day 4. The sun, moon, planets, and all of that. So what is the light? That is Christ, coming into this physical material creation, coming from the Father into this creation. Remember, the Father is infinite. He doesn't enter this creation. It is the Son who enters this creation. It is the Son who then becomes the active agent, the intercessor between the Father and this creation and all that is within this creation, which later on will include man once man is created. Once the Son imposes order on the chaos, then that is what those 6 days of creation are about. The Spirit becomes active. When the monogenesis is visible as God's Shekhinah glory, or light, He shapes the visible, bringing life out of non-life. Well, that's what salvation is. Bringing life to those who are dead. Dead in their trespasses and sins. Ephesians 2, 1 through 5. That is what He does. Brings life to non-life. Brings order to chaos. From the chaos and degradation and violence of sin, He brings peace. He raises us up out of the dirt. Many, when exposed to the gospel, reject it and return like a pig to the mud and like a dog to its vomit. Or if you have cat, like a cat to its vomit. Thus no one has seen the Father at any time. And thus no one can know the Father. And as I've said, this is a recurring theme throughout the scripture. No one knows the Father. So how do we understand the truth if we do not understand the source of the truth, or cannot receive anything from the source of the truth? As Romans 5:12, therefore, just as sin came into the world through one man, that'd be Adam, and death through sin, and so death spread to all men because all sinned. For sin indeed was in the world before the law was given, but sin is not counted where there is no law. Only the monogenesis has seen the Father. Only He can explain the Father's salvation, being eternally, or being with Him from eternity past. And that is John's major point right there. Christ is God. But He's not the God, and He's not a God. The God is the Father. As a monogenos, Genesis, He has come from the Father. But He's also God with the Father. Now, that just hurt their heads. And it would hurt their heads even more is that the monogenesis became man to die for people, His people. Thus only through Him can life come to believers. Let's go to John 14, verse 6. Jesus said to him, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. And as we read here, verses 12 and 13, to all who received him, who believed in his name, he gave the privilege to become children of God, born of the will of man. And grace and truth came through Jesus Christ.
Thus, no one else can be worshipped. Moses received truth from God. Prophets received truth from God. Jesus received truth directly from the Father. And became the active agent throughout this creation. Thus, he alone is the intercessor between God and man. Romans 5, verses 6 through 10. No other name under heaven by which men can be saved. The Jews were really having a hard time dealing with Trinitarianism, as many people are today. They rejected Trinitarian as polytheism, which they still do today, as do Islam and others. They viewed it as idolatry. The Old Testament hinted at the Son. Remember, the Spirit's already present. God, i.e. the Father, is already present. Now, they did not have the understanding that the Spirit was distinct from the Father. For them, it was a type of what today we'd call modalism, or Sabellianism, that at times he would appear as a person, sometimes you'd hear him as a voice, sometimes he would come as a spirit. It just depends what mode he wanted to take. Remember, Deuteronomy 18, verses 15 through 19, Moses said, God is going to raise up a prophet after me. And remember, when people came to talk to John the Baptist, they said, are you the prophet? And he says, no, get out of here. But he's coming, but it's not me. And oftentimes when you hear the phrase or read the phrase, angel of the Lord in the Old Testament, you are looking at Christ. It's called a theophany. In appearance before he came in the flesh. Whenever man saw God, saw a manifestation of God, that would be Christ.